those things. So when one thing changes, another thing changes.
The gross national product does not allow the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play.
One of the most powerful economists in Denmark gave a huge interview where the headline was, when I read the book, I wanted to throw it out the window. They were writing about it. Two of them gave interviews before they'd even read it. Wow. About how stupid it was. And I think they've quieted down a little bit now that it's coming out in 13 countries and sold more than 50,000 copies. So I think they kind of got around to the fact that maybe some people were quite interested in this. Mm-hmm. But they have been so used to the privilege of being able to work behind closed doors. No one in the citizenry ever asking them anything. And a lot of their power comes from that. So I think, in my opinion, what your project can do is to give us the confidence and give people the knowledge to say, no, you're not stupid. And they might ridicule you and they might say whatever, but when we have each other, it gets much easier. And I think it gives you confidence to see other people speak and to get the tools and the language to question a system that you feel in your body and mind is not working the way it was supposed to.
Hello and welcome to Invisible Handcuffs, a podcast that seeks to expose the economic ideology underpinning our crises and explore ways to free ourselves from its chains. My name is Katie Shields and I'm a recovering mainstream economist and your host. My guest this week is Emma Holton. Emma is a feminist economist and author of the best-selling book, Deficit. In this interview, we talk about what feminist economics is all about, with Emma describing it as fundamentally about exploring the concept of reproduction, the care, the love, the friendship, the compassion that makes us healthy humans capable of contributing to the productive economy. Emma was motivated to move into this field after a life-changing week in hospital, in which she talks about every euro that she has earned from after that life-saving week of care that she received from nurses that were often working on minimum wage is directly attributable to that week. And yet economic models, which often focus on the short term and which treat care as a cost to be reduced at all cost, don't see or measure that value. We start by talking about how we got here, going back to the Enlightenment era and how economics back then were seeking to create a science that could compete with Newtonian physics, that was rational, logical and calculable. We then move on to the present day and the ultimate contradiction in the liberal project that has so influenced the economics that we have today. Liberalism, which on the one hand is very much about social justice, about gender and racial justice. And yet, on the other hand, because it is also about promoting economic freedom, the freedom to make a profit and to accumulate, tends towards extracting value from people and from nature. And so we ultimately end up in a situation where the very models or the very thinking that is supposed to promote gender equality ends up reinforcing inequality. This does not just have implications for women, it has implications for all of us because care is ultimately the basis of our economies. So if we want to move towards societies that are more caring, both of each other and of nature on which we all depend, we need to move away from the kinds of models that are devaluing it today. And we also talk about the implications for our democracies, because by handing over decisions to spreadsheets, we're ultimately taking away decision-making power from citizens. I hope this interview will encourage you to engage with feminist economics. As Emma said, there is safety in numbers, and feminist economics is one of a number of fields seeking to challenge the mainstream. My takeaway from this interview is that it is an indispensable field that we need to engage more with. With that, please join me in welcoming economist Emma Holton. So, welcome, Emma. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to dive right in. We met a couple of months ago in Scotland at the Scotland's Economics Festival, which is kind of a gathering of alternative or heterodox economists. And you mentioned to me there that you enjoyed being there because you're a heterodox economist yourself and you feel kind of lonely in this world in Denmark. So maybe you can start by saying, you know, why do you feel lonely and what are you doing in Denmark as a heterodox economist?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not a classically trained economist. So I'm a political economist, I usually say. So that's a distinction that some people care about a lot. I don't care about it so much, but some people care about it a lot. And I think it's my impression that Denmark although we are so famous for, you know, having this progressive welfare state, having loads of gender equality, being very, you know, forward on climate, blah, blah, all this, I think there is a very romanticized image of Denmark sometimes. But despite all this, we actually, in my opinion, have a quite conservative class of economists in our country. And I think it's maybe because the country is so small that, you know, of course, the smaller a country is and a language is, the less diversity there tends to be. And I think it was just such a joy for me to be in Edinburgh at the Scotonomics Festival, because sometimes when you're working against the current, as I would say I am in some respects, you do have these moments where you just sit on your bed and look in the mirror and you're like, am I ill in the head? Is there something fundamental that I am misunderstood? Like, are all these people who are saying that I'm an idiot, are they right? And I think it's a healthy thought to have, but it can also become somewhat of a burden. And I think when I was at the Scotland Economics Festival, I met all these people who were so smart and talented and well-bred and thoughtful. And I thought, okay, these people are much smarter than me. And if they think that I like am onto something true, then it must be right. So it gave me a boost in swimming a little bit against the current.
Well, I'm pretty sure that you are as smart as many of the people that we met there. And I also think we can quote one of our another female economist, Joan Robinson, in saying that, you know, we learn economics not to be economists, but not to be fooled by them. And I often say when I'm teaching heterodox economics that it's about helping you not be gaslit by economists. So, but
there's
it's
a
hard.
Lot of that.
Yeah. And it's hard, as you say, when it dominates the narrative so much. So I'd love to get into that. But I think maybe also particularly for our audience, you're the first feminist economist that we have on this series. Can you explain a little bit about how you would define feminist economics?
Yeah, sure. So I think many people come to heterodox economics because of the climate and the natural crisis. So we have this crisis of resources, we have a crisis of heating climate, of us not taking care of nature. But we have also another way into heterodox economics, which is that we are in a care crisis. We're in a mental health crisis. We're in a recruiting crisis all over Europe and the world. We're having difficulty seeing people, getting people to work in the care sector, and people are going down with stress, exhaustion within the care sector. And that was kind of my way into heterodox economics and trying to understand what is going on with our inability to take care of people. All this tremendous wealth that we have, why is it not being converted into mental well-being? Like, for example, like I said, I live in Denmark, richest country in the world almost, and we're seeing declining rates of well-being and have been for 20 years. And this is a theme all over Europe. And so what we work with in feminist economics is care work. And it's called feminist economics not because it's just relevant to women, but because women are overrepresented in care work and have always been overrepresented in care work. So what we're interested in is who does care work? Who takes care of bodies and minds? Do they have enough resources? Are they highly valued enough? And what we find very quickly when you start to kind of scratch the surface of mainstream economics is that mainstream economics has a huge issue with care. It has very limited and poor language to describe it. Sometimes it even says that its value is zero or an expense rather than an investment, et cetera, et cetera. And in feminist economics, we work with trying to counter this narrative and say that, you know, care is not something we pay for after we have an economy. Actually, care work is the work that makes all other work possible. So if that doesn't work, all the other parts of the economy fall apart. And I think, in my opinion, that's what we're seeing happening in many places now.
Yeah. So there are a few points that you mentioned there around value, but maybe we can
sort of come back to, you've written a book called Deficit, which goes into also kind of the history of where this comes from. So what I found really fascinating, your book, you sort of went right back to where, you know, where economics started out in the Enlightenment era. Ida, can you talk a little bit about how views of women then have sort of then infiltrated and then kind of also reinforced themselves in economics today?
Yeah, I think the reason that I wanted to go into history was that I really wanted to give economics as a science a fair shot. And I wanted to explain how this happened. Because what happens in the Enlightenment, when we kind of start having the thoughts that end up becoming what's economics today, is that there is this really honorable ambition to describe the world clearly and rationally and logically without having it be affected by emotion and religion and all these feely-feely things. And that means that they become extremely good at describing things that are quite simple to observe: factories, production, buying and selling. But what happens is that the home and everything that has to do with feelings and bodies, which after all is the core of the economy, it becomes a little bit of a black box for these thinkers. And I think there is a psychological thing that happens, which is that they also perceive the home and the body and illness and sex and all these things as private. And they don't want to kind of get mixed up in all that. So what they do is they close the home down, and it ends up having huge consequences for what becomes the core interest of economics, which is the individual and the actions of the individual. And I think it's understandable why the individual becomes the focus, because after all, we are individuals. But what disappears from view is that we are all connected to one another. So every individual is born by another individual, is raised, learns to speak, to walk, to engage, to think by other individuals. And those relationships, how human beings are developed and maintained, that becomes simply not something that economics talks that much about. And they're trying to catch up and working more with it now. The problem is, though, that the methods they have developed that they're still using have absolutely no way of dealing with those types of relationships. They're very good at, you know, buying and selling cars and those types of things. But when it comes to, you know, being with your child, giving birth, getting sick, dying, these types of bodily and human functions, they have no way of really grasping both, neither what the value of it is to people, what it merely means to us, but not either what it means to the rest of the economy. So the entire area of taking care of bodies and minds is, in my opinion, still a black box in economics. And that's what we're trying to fix with feminist economics.
And unfortunately, it is true today. So as you say, economists are trying very belatedly to catch up. We still have a lot of male dominance issues in economics.
Yeah. They have a 600-year lag. So,
right. And that they still identify between kind of just two types of activity, this work and leisure. I actually looked at a current economics textbook, a major one that is used online, and indeed it still refers to that. It's sort of, I think, not leisure but free time, or that people might choose, because economics models are also kind of still focused on individual choices. They might choose, you know, to look after their children if paid care is not available. So can I ask a little bit about that then? Because, you know, you talk as well in your book about kind of the difference between paid care and unpaid care, and also how the paid care is also done by women. Can you kind of talk to how these models then reproduce those kind of injustices around also paid care work?
Yeah, for sure. So what we see is that still today, all over the world, without any exceptions, women are massively overrepresented in both unpaid and paid care. So what that means is that if you are a woman, the chances are you're going to be spending a lot of your life looking after other people's bodies and minds, both for free in the home and also when you're at work. Mm-hmm. And this means that you are, as a woman, you have a very large chance of doing work that is overlooked. And what happens in to care work is that, in my opinion, we tend to talk about culture on one side and economics on the other. as if they are unrelated. But what I show in the book is that it is this evil cycle where something is economically devalued, which is the case for care work, and then it becomes culturally devalued as well. And because it has a low cultural value, it gets a low economic value. And then that cycle kind of never ends. And we have these jobs that have the opposite thing. You know, working at a bank, for example, much money, much respect, without us really asking, wait, which of these two can we not live without? Which of these two is actually creating something that is very, very central to the economy? I think it was David Graeber, and a big, big inspiration to me, who unfortunately passed away a couple of years ago. But he said that it seems to me that in our society, the more obvious it is that you have a job that helps people, the less you seem to be paid. And I think that goes for care work to like the nth degree, right? What happens is, and I think one of the reasons that economics for me is so important is that we oftentimes talk about capitalism, right, as a system. And we say, you know, capitalism is this for-profit system and care suffers in capitalism. And I think that's very true. However, what I find and what I show in Deficit is that we also have the language of economics, which actually legitimizes the devaluation of care within capitalism, because within economics, they typically use market prices to describe value. So if I say to an economist, you know, I think that a nurse can save three lives during 1 week, but she only makes, you know, 1,500 euros a month. He'll say, but 1,500 euros a month, if she was doing work that was so important, she would be making more. What she's making is the value that she has. And that's how we talk about it in GDP. That's how we talk about it in economics. And that creates a huge issue because the work that nurses do and the work that home carers do is relational, right? So it's the care you do, it's long lasting, it's long term, it's complex. You never know what's going to happen. So I think, in my opinion, the reason that care is excluded from economics is not because they are sexists and don't care about women. It is because the work that women do are simply of a completely different character than a lot of other work in the economy. So when you're in a factory and you produce a car, there the car is, and we can talk about it and we can buy it and sell it. But a psychologist, for example, or a nurse or a child carer, it's a much more complex product, right? Because you're imbuing something on a human being that they're carrying with them, and we don't really know what they're going to be using it for. And I think this unpredictability and flexibility and slinkiness, you could call it, of care and of the body is what really challenges the economic system and capitalism as well.
And I think I wonder what you think of this. So I would agree with all that. And, you know, we've had this problem throughout time, but we did have a period, at least kind of in the post-war era, in parts of Europe, where care work and this kind of more caring parts of the economy were at least funded. I'm sure there's still a lot of kind of like gender, you know, gender stereotypes and so on within that. But, and I think for me, this is what is interesting, what we're also trying to get to with this series, is that whereas in other segments of the society, we might have seen, you know, progress on gender issues, on race and other kinds of injustices more, the particular way that economics has developed, especially more recently, especially in this kind of push to make states function more like markets, make them more efficient, are actually often shifting, then reinforcing the kind of... the worst aspects of that. I don't know if I've articulated that well.
No, I know exactly what you're describing. About that. I think this was something that was very important to me in writing Deficit, because I really wanted it to be a book for a wider audience. I wanted people who were, you know, nurses to read it. I wanted people in elder care to read it, because I wanted to give them some ammunition to have these conversations about how they're talked about in politics. And I think something that was very important for me to show them was that we are all raised in this paradigm where we are told that economics is like physics or chemistry, right? That if I ask an economist in Tokyo or Berlin how to solve a problem, we're told they'll tell you the same thing. But what you find is that is simply not true. that there are paradigms and disagreements about what is a good economy, what does wealth mean, what is valuable. And what I show in Deficit is that actually, as you describe in the post-war period, or what we call the Keynesian period sometimes, is that there was this window where we saw the public sector as an investment. So that meant that we said, okay, if we educate people well, if we teach them how to be socially function well, if we take care of them and when they are ill, that will strengthen the economy because the resource of human beings will be more competent. And I think Denmark, where I live, is a perfect example of the huge success of this system, right? We are a country of 6 million people, but we have startups and are very, very rich and a very well-functioning country in many, many ways just because of this system. But what happens in the end of the 80s, and especially, in my opinion, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, is that there comes into the political system this idea that ideology is dead. And now we need to just rule the state with science. And the science that they choose is economics. And the economic science is in a big change at this period because it is going from saying that the public services are an investment to believing more that public services are an expense and that the true value is being created in the private sector. And I think this is the language that most people in Europe will recognize now, right? We say that the private sector pays for the public sector. But how I would see it is that value goes both ways, right? That the private sector gets a lot from the public sector as well. And this is, and I show this in the book, this is a very concrete shift that happens in worldview in economics. And what was really stunning to me was that most economists who are taught economics today are not taught that there was this huge change in how they looked at society. Mm-hmm. They have an impression that it's always been like this. And I think that that was something that was extremely interesting to me, that many people who are taught in this discipline, they are also taught that it's like physics or chemistry. And it doesn't take long to study economic history to show that there has always been huge disagreement. The type of models that I criticize today, which are the models that looks at care as an expense, it was a huge debate within economics whether they were a good idea. And we have an amazing political economist, Oddný Helgadóttir, here in Copenhagen, who has studied why did these models become so popular and so widely used. And what she shows is that it didn't have anything to do with them being better or more true. They needed less computer power. They were popular among some strategically placed economists. There were also some lobbying some places. And I think that I really wanted to show that economics has within it a power struggle about how we see the world. And I think most regular people are not exposed to this. They just are they get these numbers thrown into their face and they're not allowed to criticize them. They're not allowed to question them. And I really wanted to give us the confidence when an economist comes to your hospital ward and you work as a nurse and they say, we want to fire four of your colleagues and save 500,000 euros. I wanted to give the nurses the confidence to say, where are you getting that number from? How did you reach that? Or have you thought about this and this and this and this? And I think we have a lot of respect for numbers in our culture. I think maybe a little bit too much respect.
So I think we are getting to the one of the theories that we're working on with this project is that how then this is upheld and reproduced and why also there is so much pushback with, I would put feminist economics maybe together with ecological economics is among the kind of newer thought schools, right? You mentioned Keynesianism, we could talk about Marxism or institutionalism, but because, as you say, because of this rift and because of this sort of shutting down of other thought schools, the debate that you talked about isn't happening anymore. And so when you come with something really new, it throws these mainstream economists, or as you call them, established economists, because it's so outside of their paradigm. I can actually hear like myself, you know, I'm listening to you when the way I used to think, thinking, no, wait a minute. What do we used to say? We say, no, but you have to compare apples with apples, Emma. You just need to put them into monetary terms and then we work out the costs and benefits. And and then we have this nice clear stretchy. Yeah. But as you say, and you refer to some of these studies in your books as well, you can get wildly different estimates. In fact, you can almost get any number you want from some of these models.
Yeah, and I think that this is something that's very, very central, right? That I think there was this ambition to see the world clearly and to describe it with numbers. And that was perceived and is still perceived within economics as apolitical. And I think this was something that stunned me when I started working closely with economics and talking with them about my book, is that many of them perceive their theories to be completely neutral. And I say to them, you know, how can you say that using prices to measure value is neutral? When we're sitting here with a nurse at a cancer ward making, you know, 1,500 euros, and then we have a hedge fund manager moving money around in a spreadsheet, making, you know, 10,000 euros or 200,000 euros a month. How can you still believe this? And it just, you see, when you ask that question, they don't even really know exactly how to respond, because what they will say to me then is that, okay, but the issue is that the nurse is employed in the public sector. And if she was in the private sector, she would get money that reflects her worth. And I can just say, we have nurses in the private sector in a place like America, and they don't make jack shit money either. So it's not a solution to this issue. And I think there is just within economics a tremendous faith in the market due to the theory that I describe in the book called marginalism, which is a theory that the price of something will describe its worth. The trust in that is just, in my opinion, and I'm going to say this, I mean it in a kind way, it is almost a little bit religious. And then they'll say, oh, yeah, I know there are some market failures and blah, blah, blah. But that means that the way that many economists approach the market is that it is a perfect thing that gets destroyed by human beings. And if we can just fix the things that are wrong, these little market failures, then everything will be right. Instead of saying, actually, the market is not something that is outside human beings. It is always defined by human beings. And you cannot keep calling human beings a failure. If the failure isn't every market, it's not a failure, it's a substantive part of the system you're trying to describe. And I think that is what strikes me often, is that there is something that I admire in economics, which is a tremendous abstraction level, an ability to really see society from on up high and understand what's going on. And that is a very powerful tool within a science. But it does sometimes do that in order to reach that abstraction level, you have to abstract away concrete lived reality. And I think that especially in the area of care, but also nature, city planning, all these places where we use cost-benefit analysis, for example, it can lead you to a situation where you're abstracting away everything that really matters to people and that shapes their daily lives.
I think marginalism was a great tool as well to sort of move away from, sort of to depoliticize in a way, decision making.
Exactly.
And I think when you mentioned power there, I get the impression that economists, and I'd love to know also maybe a bit, if we can talk about interactions you've had, but are maybe not aware of the power of these spreadsheets, but also what an alternative could look like. So just making a democratic decision of what we want to do as a society, what is important. Maybe can you talk to that at all?
Yeah, I think this is actually, in my opinion, this is my main gripe with economics, to be honest, because I think what happened after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the kind of bureaucratization of a lot of political processes was that the central question of policy, which is what does it mean to live a good life, that became a bureaucratic question instead of a democratic question. So the question of what is valuable, what means something, that is not something that we decide democratically anymore. And I think we cannot underestimate that right now we are living in a situation, both in the States and in Europe and in many countries around the world, where the frustration with especially kind of center-right and center-left parties is huge. People are so angry on both the left and the right. And people are polarizing up out towards the the flanks, right? So we just saw it in the UK today. They're counting up the election. And what we're seeing is that Labour and Conservative are losing to Reform and the Greens. So, and we're seeing exactly the same movement in Denmark. Same in Germany with AfD and the left. Everywhere is the same. And I think that's because these big centre parties adopted this one size fits all definition of value, which was GDP growth, productivity growth, labor supply reforms, increased consumption. And with that came increased consumption, with that came also increased inequality, lack of investment in care, lack of investment in zones outside the big cities. And I think it's interesting that some of the points that ecological and feminist and heterodox economists have made for a long time, which is that the market cannot solve everything. The state has to be active in places as well, that has been perceived for a long time within economics as just illegal, right? That every time the state gets involved, it distorts the market, it distorts competition. But just the other day, Ernst & Young, the huge consulting firm, came out and said, industrial policy is back. The market prices do not reflect value. We have just seen the UN panel on post-GDP growth coming out and saying the same thing. Even the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, have come out and said our previous policy on industrial policy, which was hands off the state, I think they wrote that it was as useful as a floppy disk. and I think it does feel vindicating, but it also feels tremendously frustrating because for a long time, we have just been ridiculed for saying this market is shaped by the state. The state comes first and then comes the market. And I think many economists right now are a little bit scrambling to update their priors to situation that we're in now and to solving issues like geopolitical issues, climate issues, and care issues, because the tools they have been given, which is basically marketize everything in many cases, simply cannot answer the questions that we're sitting with right now.
I don't know if we're at a stage yet that we might see the mainstream, you know, collaborate with these other schools.
Let's see.
At least there seems to be, So one theory I'm working on, at least, and I think we talked about a little bit this in Scotland, is that partly because these other schools, which also don't fully agree with each other on everything, are kind of pushed to the side, that there's more, you know, there's more collaboration within them. There's, you mentioned industrial policy, which is also being taken up by sort of post-growth, you know, scholars and things like that. Yeah, maybe can you talk to that? Are you seeing any developments there? I don't know what it's like in Denmark or elsewhere.
I think for me, writing deficit also stemmed from many different types of frustrations. But one of them was that in Denmark, we have an incredibly vital and smart climate and nature movement. And actually, in the past 10 years, we've gotten also a very clever and vital feminist and rights-based and identity politics movement. And what I saw was that these movements are completely separate. Like, they have nothing to do with each other. and all these people who were doing tremendous work, they were not pulling in different directions, but they were not coordinating and organizing their work. And I think that's where feminist economics is so useful to me, because it shows that actually there is a path forward where the care crisis and the nature crisis are kind of solved and attacked in tandem. And what I write in Deficit is that nature and unpaid care are fellow sufferers in the economy. They suffer under the same system, which is misvaluation. And in my opinion, in a green world, in a greener world where we take better care of our planet and all with our planet, also ourselves, many, many more people should be working with care, both in the private sector and the public sector. It is green work. It is sustainable work. And when we lessen our consumption, it also frees up time to do other things. And in economics, that'll often be seen as less value. So if we lessen consumption, we feel poorer. But what feminist economics tells us is, no, wait, actually, the time we spend outside of work, which is unpriced, actually is something that when you really ask people, it is the most valuable thing to them. So, and I think this is an experience I have in Denmark all the time. So when I tell people, you know, okay, so if we imagine a future like this, where you give up the new kitchen, you give up some dresses from H&M, you give up maybe the charter vacation to Mallorca, but instead you get a childcare that is a Rolls Royce of childcare. You get 4 hours a day with your children to just play outside of work. You get parks and recreation. You get free physical therapy for everybody, free psychologists for everybody. Would that be a trade you would be interested in? And people say, it would be a transition, but for sure, like, you've got my attention. Like, that sounds something like something I could get on board with. And suddenly the question about, you know, degrowth and restructuring our consumption seems not like something that would make us poorer, but something that would make us richer. And I think that's where feminist economics can really supply something to the green movement, because we are speaking about what creates value for people's lives and minds. And I think sometimes in the green movement, there is this, yes, you will have to give up your consumption, you will have to live on less, like this sometimes a little bit dystopian language that they get accused of, right? And I think we could help with saying, actually, for many people, having time, more time for care, and having better and using the resources for better care work would be seen for them as getting richer. And that's just a completely different way of looking at it than economics does right now.
Great. So you know, you wrote this deficit. It's now in, you mentioned sort of several languages already translated, up to 10, I think, overall.
Yeah, it's been, I think 10 are out and it's coming out in 13 all in all, I think. Spain and Portugal is on the way. Japan is on the way. Hungary. I actually lost a little bit of grip on this and several other things in my life. I'm just going with the flow.
Well, I mean, it's a testament to, I think, the clarity as well that you've written with and communicated these issues.
You.
So I certainly, have found a huge valuable resource. I wonder apart from sort of going out and talking about the book, and which is in itself is wonderful, is there anything, you know, or maybe you can talk a little bit about to the reactions that are coming from it?
I think what seems to be the most important, and what I think, in my opinion, is the primary, or one of the primary things that we need to do in feminism, or one of the primary tasks, is that it gives language to lived experience. So I think so many people, both people in care and outside care, had like an inkling, like something is wrong. We're structuring this society all wrong. And I think that frustration, it can take many shapes, right? It can take shape in a more right-wing direction where you become a trad wife, or it can take shape in a left-wing direction where you become a climate warrior, right? But in my opinion, these reactions, while they are different, they seem to be reacting to the same thing, which is I cannot live my life on the terms that have been set out by this society. I simply must opt out of all this bullshit. What I really wanted Deficit to do, and what it has done, which is just such a privilege and an honor, is that, or what many people tell me, is that it has given them a language for a feeling that they had, and given them a sense, oh my goodness, they're actually names for something, like a mother having mental load. There is something called unpaid care work. And the sense that you have that we're valuing the wrong things, and that you're spending your entire life on things that don't seem to be important, and that it's happening at the cost of what really matters, like, that is true. You can prove it, that is actually what's happening. And I think that's the really response that I got. And I think that goes for just regular people, but for people who are working in care, it really has been like a call to arms in many ways, because it has shown that in the models that we use in finance departments all over the world, including every single country in Europe, they are using models where money spent on care is seen as something that creates absolutely no value, and where it looks as if you can remove money from the care sector without losing anything. And I think many people working in the care sector have had a sense like, why are we making these decisions that are so stupid, that hurts children, hurts mm-hmm. sick people, hurts us who are working here? And suddenly they could see, actually, this is the reason. Because politicians mm-hmm. look at a piece of paper that says, the less care we have, the richer we are. Yeah. And it gave them kind of a target for their wrath. And I think that wrath needed a target. And the target was not only political, it was also bureaucratic. And bureaucracy is often hidden from view of regular citizens. And I really wanted it out in the front and say, you know, are you aware that this is happening and that this is how they count? And where this is where these numbers are coming from.
Mm. And this is why I think, like what you're talking about there, it makes so much sense to combine the social and the ecological movements, because we see the same problem with the way that energy and nature are accounted for. You know, energy is like 2 or 3% of GDP. No, it's not. It's actually the entire economy doesn't exactly. function without energy. It also doesn't function without care. We take these things away, we have no economy. So I think getting it and articulating that. So maybe, and I want to be respectful of your time. I know you've got to run to another appointment. Maybe I have two kind of closing questions, which you're welcome to take in either order. One would be if you've got anything for people listening, anything that you think they could do if they've listened to these issues that we're talking about and they care. And maybe also if you have any feedback on our work. I've explained a little bit about what we're trying to do. Our project's called Invisible Handcuffs. We are trying to make visible a lot of these assumptions, the ways that these decisions are being taken, so that people can sort of work with us to reclaim economics.
I think what I would really encourage people to do is that, of course, what we're just talking about today are huge systems. And as an individual, it is extremely difficult to affect them. However, what you can do, and what we know from the feminist movement, is what really matters, is to question authority. And that was, if you look at feminist history and women's history, what really mattered was when women started questioning authority and men started questioning authority on behalf of women and saying, well, actually, why? Please explain to me again, why are we doing it like this? And I think one of the things we can do right now that is extremely important, both for climate and for social issues that I'm working on, is to move our attention to real resources and away from money only. Because it's so interesting, because every time I talk about care with people, they say, oh, but how will we get the money to pay for all this care? And I say, how will you get money if the care is not working? And we are so afraid of not having enough money, but we never ask ourselves, where will we get the natural resources if we use them all up? Where will we get new inventions if people are depressed and not feeling happy? And I think that is something that's going to be happening now, both with the energy crisis, with the geopolitical crisis and the care and nature crisis, is that we're going to see a renewed focus on real resources, because that is mm-hmm. what the economy is made of. You can have as much money as you want in the bank, but if people are not happy and healthy, if you don't have natural resources, if you don't have transport, if you don't have housing, then none of that will work. So I think focusing on real resources, and when you observe the political debate and you talk to people about politics, don't talk about the lack of money. Talk about the capacity of a country. I think that is really, really important. Are we getting smarter? Are we living longer? Are we healthier? That's the type of questions I'm asking. And in terms of your work, I think we need all hands on deck for this, because this is a huge and invisible power structure. And I think it is so central to challenge these types of narratives. But it is very difficult right now because of what we talked about before, that the people who speak in this way are tremendously powerful and they will not balk at ridiculing or humiliating you. And I think this is something that I think I maybe, even though I write about it in the book, I still did underestimate it once the book came out. You know, there were economists in Denmark who said that they wanted to throw my book out the window. Yeah. One of the most powerful economists in Denmark gave a huge interview where the headline was, when I read the book, I wanted to throw it out the window. They were writing about it. Two of them gave interviews before they'd even read it about how stupid it was. And I think they've quieted down a little bit now that it's coming out in 13 countries and sold more than 50,000 copies. So I think they kind of got around to the fact that maybe some people were quite interested in this. Mm-hmm. But they have been so used to the privilege of being able to work behind closed doors. No one mm-hmm. in the citizenry ever asking them anything. And a lot of their power comes from that. So I think, in my opinion, what your project can do is to give us the confidence and give people some knowledge to say, no, you're not stupid. And they might ridicule you and they might say whatever, but when we have each other, it gets much easier. And I think it gives you confidence to see other people speak and to get the tools and the language to question a system that you feel in your body and mind is not working the way it was supposed to.
Well, thank you, Emma. I'll certainly do our best to do that. I was just envisioning there, maybe we'll come up to Denmark and do a book throwing some mainstream economic textbooks out of some hospitals with some care workers.
Oh my goodness. I would really enjoy that. That would be very vindicating for me.
Okay, I'll be planning a trip. Thank you so much once again. Thank you for everything that you're doing. All the best, and I hope we'll certainly stay in touch and organize that trip up to Denmark.
I will be holding my windows open for you. Have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you, Emma.
So much for having me. Enjoy the spring.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Invisible Handcuffs, Unchaining Economics, hosted by me, Katie Shields, with music, art and production by Philip Melchers. If you've enjoyed this episode, please consider liking and following us on YouTube or your favourite podcasting platform, and by subscribing on our website at invisiblehandcuffs.com, where you can also find the show notes to this episode and more about the project. With that, thank you for listening, and I hope to see you next time.